This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing on the Battle of Iwo Jima as we zero in on the 75th anniversary of that legendary World War II battle. Teenage Marine Max Roof had already been wounded once on Saipan before he ever came ashore on Iwo Jima.
I got the impression from what people were telling me, or the officers and so forth, that it was going to be a tough battle. But we've already been through tough battles, so don't you guys wet it. Don't worry about it, because we'll get through it. And that's kind of, I took that as a reasonable thought in my mind, that it was going to be, it ended up being a lot tougher than we thought it was going to be, or was thinking it was going to be.
Well, you'd already made a couple landings, so maybe it was nothing that new trying to land on Iwo Jima, although I've heard that the surf there gave the LCVPs quite a job trying to land troops successfully on that ground-up volcanic rock.
Yes, that was interesting on that part of it. That I could go on for a lot more stories in different ways, but that was tough. And fellows waving, said, "Come on in, come on in, come on in," you know, because they were starting to shell. The bombs were coming in now, wasn't the last one. I was about in the middle of the group
and the Japanese, of course, from atop Mount Suribachi, had all that artillery shooting down at you trying to get on the beach.
Exactly, and we need to get off the beach. And this one time that I remember, I got off the beach, and boy, they were just, bombs were going like mad, shells were, and so forth, and I spotted this little hole over here, kind of a cave like. I said, "Let me get in that and get out of this mess for a minute, you know." And so I got in there, and it was all dark, and I couldn't see. But finally, I could see what was in there was shells and bombs and so forth, to be picked up somewhere along the way by the Japanese themselves. It was their own weapons. And so I said, "I'm gonna get out of here," because they were showing they were just a mess. So I got out of that deal. And I found out later that it well, it hit and really exploded, but I wasn't there.
Thankfully, good thing you got out when you did. And for people who aren't familiar, there were caves like that and a network of tunnels all over that island where the Japanese had guns, and you guys didn't know about much of that.
That is exactly correct, and we didn't. Unfortunately, most of our, about the 30 or 40 people that I was involved with, in it and out of it, so to speak, about half of them made it. I was one of them that did make it, mostly. I was
Well, that's debatable. We have to hear that story. From the time that you hit the beach to the time that you were wounded on Iwo Jima, how much time passed there? How early on in the battle were you hit?
It was way back into the middle, almost. I wasn't hit on the beach itself. I got hit further back in, when they finally got a whole bunch of Japanese armor and actually men got came through and was hitting a bunch of us that got hit bad, and they did it, and that was what they're there for. But I was able to at least get back alive, I came back in a. They didn't think I was even alive.
Well, I want to ask you more about that and get all the details, but between the time that you got there and the time you were wounded, there was a lot happening on this island. And, of course, the most famous thing that happened on that island is something that you were there for. The flag went up. Well, it went up twice. Two different flags went up atop Mount Suribachi.
You're right.
What do you remember seeing and hearing, and what did it mean to you?
Well, I was in front. I never forget it. That one time, with a lot of explosion going on, and I was kind of digging in along with about 10 other guys that were trying to get underneath it a little bit. So I did look back this one time, and seeing that we were kind of taking it over, but I was moving forward to fight the Japanese out there that were still there, but it was, in a sense, kind of exciting to be there to see that we're taking things over, at least physically, and I hope mentally as well.
But there's no time to cheer when somebody's shooting at you.
No, it wasn't. It was either die or not die. We had no choice. But that was okay. We made it out, and several thousand, I said earlier, that was killed in Evo, and I wasn't one of them. But I had eventually four back operations, hip replacement, and a lot of internal injuries and so forth. But I came out fairly good.
Well, from what I hear, you came out awfully strong. Your wife is vouching for that.
My wife is the one that did it all. She is so powerful.
I want to hear the rest of this story, but I do want to ask you one more thing about Mount Suribachi and that indelible image, that Rosenthal photo of the group hoisting that flag. That photo is on the back of your business card. When you look at that photo now, when you look at the Marine Corps statue at Arlington National Cemetery there that honors those men and everyone who fought there, what do you think of when you see that image?
One thing, I feel proud. I really do. And I'm so proud that I went into the Marines. Even though I got banged up pretty bad, but to me, I was proud, and I still am.
And I don't blame you. And of course, if anyone's been to that beautiful statue near Washington, D.C., that brings that photograph to life in a 3D sense, they've seen the quote on the side from Admiral Nimitz that says, "Among the Marines in the Pacific, uncommon valor was a common virtue." Is that something that means something to you? Do you believe that to be true? Is that what you saw in the guys that you served with?
I have to say yes. In the Marines, good people now that I've loved dearly, who's Lieutenant Colonel and John Lockey, for example, and just guys that are just so super in every way and so thoughtful and so helpful in watching him and handle other Marines that need help in the way of mentally particularly. So I just am thrilled that I'm part of that. I'm way under of their caliber, I'm telling you, but they really make me proud.
Are you saying once a Marine, always a Marine? Is that what I hear?
That's what you heard, sir. That's exactly correct.
Well, let's talk about this injury, because I know we've alluded to it a few times. But if you can, share with our listeners the details of what happened to you, what you were doing, where you got hit, what it felt like. Walk me through that if you can. What were you doing at that time?
I was fighting with a rifle, guys coming in like mad, Marines, and fighting Marines, I should say, but guys that were the Japanese, but also more Marines were coming in trying to protect. Everybody was there, too. And when I got hit... the first time I got hit, or on Net Island, I almost mentally lost it. I just knew that I was hurt bad, but I kept kind of fighting, but not really. I kind of figured out what do I do next? Where do I go? And how do I get out of here? But I couldn't and didn't until they picked me up in a blanket and got me out.
So it was shrapnel from a landmine and fragments of a hand grenade that got you at the same time?
Mostly hand grenades that got hit me badly.
Where did it get you?
Pretty much all over in my body and so forth. But again, I got out. I went immediately to the hospital, shipped out to the hospital. Then immediately flew me on to Guam. And I was in Guam Hospital for several months and before I got back to Hawaii. And then they shipped me on into San Francisco and then home.
Well, I'm sorry for all these questions about the same thing, but when you say that it took you several months to recover, I think we can all tell these were pretty serious injuries. And this hit your front, not your back? I mean, did you get it in the face, the shoulders? Where did it all go?
Can't answer that intelligently. I was bleeding all over. I got hit on the back very seriously, and that's where I had four back operations.
I know that when there's an explosion, when there's shrapnel, sometimes you can be blinded temporarily.
That was exactly correct. I did go blind, matter of fact. As the operator on my eyes when they flew me to Guam, and I was... I couldn't see for about 2 weeks, and then they operated on three different times, the doctor told me later. So eyes was a bad thing in my face and so forth, but you wouldn't take anything very large to knock your eye out, you know. So.
Did you lose consciousness? Were you aware of what was going on, or were you completely out of it?
I would have to say I was aware of it. I wasn't completely out of it. I was hurting pretty bad. Wasn't crying like some of them were, and I wasn't. Didn't mean that's bad. I just hurting. But I made it through.
Obviously, you couldn't evacuate yourself. You couldn't move yourself out of there. You had to wait for a corpsman to come help you.
I had to wait for almost an hour for some. That they were picking other people up as well, and I was in the group where, a lot of them were dead completely, in the same area, and they. Two guys would pick us up, take us on over to the next little spot, and then somebody else would take over, and then they would come back and try to get somebody else.
The battle's still raging on. It's not like they say, time out, we need to get some guys out of here. You have to wait for the guys that are actually walking to get you out. That seems like a very helpless situation to me. When you know you're hurt, you know you're bleeding, you can't move yourself, you're waiting for an hour. What kept you focused on surviving in that hour? That's probably one of the longest hours of your life, I would imagine.
It was pretty severe, I'll have to admit that. I couldn't get to me, you know, but it was hurting so bad that I wasn't sure I was going to make it, frankly.
When you're in a situation like that with so many casualties as there were on that island in particular, sometimes stretchers can be in high demand and they're not always there when you need them. So they didn't have a stretcher to carry you out and they actually put you in a body bag?
A body bag's what it was, and there were too many guys having need to help, you know, and... So I don't even see a stretcher now. Looking back, all I seen was body bags, guys picking up in bag bags. There'd be two guys, one in front, one back, and they'd get us in and go.
You're not completely there in a situation like that when you're so severely wounded, but if you are starting to think you're not going to make it, then putting you in a body bag doesn't encourage you very much, I wouldn't imagine.
I didn't even think about it. No, it didn't even dawn on me that I should be on something else. Where's my stretcher? It didn't even occur to me.
So they took you to Guam, and you said months of recovery. It seems like that would be a challenging time to you, too. What do you remember about that time period and the challenges that you faced just to be able to function again?
Yeah, that was tough. I have to admit that because I really was hurting all over, not just my eyes, but my whole body. For a long, long time, I couldn't walk, and it was miserable, I got to say that. And then when I couldn't talk either, I'm not talking very good now, I admit that. But then I was really, I stuttered just 100% almost. You couldn't even understand me. And why I could go out and start my own business to talk to people on how to do this, I mean, talk about even whitewashing, you know, because I got it done. And I got the jobs that I wanted. The timing was right. It wasn't that I was that good, but it was just timing was good, and they needed the job done, and nobody else was doing it, so okay, give them a try, you know.
I know it's been a long time since then, but when you think back of that time after you were injured, the long recovery, and then trying to get yourself back into life, was there one thing that really motivated you or picked you up or kept you moving forward?
Sure was. One thing. And this sounds kind of goofy, but I did not want to be poor. That was the big thing. As I mentioned to you, my folks were just lovely, lovely, lovely. But because they lost all their money in back in the 30s in the Depression, and then they never recovered, really. And so I never experienced anything except I just didn't want to be just poor. I just had to make that was the main thing that made me go forward, and I have to say, be successful, and we were. And with six children and a beautiful wife, I was successful all over. And I thank God, generally at least once a week, sometimes often than that, for what He's given me, because I just, there's no other way I could have got it without. And then this young lady here that I married, she's perfect. I could die tomorrow and smile, literally could smile, because I've done it all. And that's how I feel inside.
If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to the complete original interviews with the Iwo Jima survivors you're hearing from today as we mark the 75th anniversary of a five-week engagement that cost the lives of nearly 7,000 Americans and left nearly 20,000 more wounded. We'll hear another of Iwo's Purple Heart stories when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.